Support for Politics and Public Policy reporting on SDPB is made possible by SDN Communications, your business broadband provider. Learn more at sdncommunications.com.
And welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. It's time for the Dakota Political Junkies. With us today, we have John Hunter. He's publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. John, welcome back. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. I'm glad to be here.
He's joining us on the phone. And in SDPB's Black Hills studio, we have with us Seth Tupper, Rapid City Journal Enterprise reporter. Hey, Seth.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, let's start. You know, I look at our list today, and we have things like Marcy's Law and education spending, and I'm thinking some ideas or some topics just, they never go away. We're not done talking. You would think maybe we wouldn't be talking about Marcy's Law anymore, but we are because there's a primary coming up, and it will be on the ballot. John, as we look at some of the coverage about potential changes to Marcy's Law, who's for it? No one's really has an organized effort against it, except for its position on the ballot at this time instead of at the general election. What are your overall thoughts about how this has been handled?
I think it's been handled very well. You know, instantly after the law was passed, there were discovered to be some challenges with that, and kind of legitimate challenges. In other words, people were following the law, but let's call it unintended consequences. Yeah. And so that was made attention of the state legislature, and they started working on what could be fixed in this thing. Actually, I think at the very beginning they say this isn't working, it's maybe we should repeal it. But they reached out to the sponsor of this nationwide, and there's a big organization trying to get Marcy's Law passed in all states, and reached out to them and said, look, can this be fixed? And they worked together and came up with something that now is on the ballot. It's supported by just about everybody, including those sponsors, said, look, it was an imperfect law. And primarily it hurt kind of law enforcement from a couple different standpoints and the general public in a standpoint or two. So everyone agreed that this would improve that situation, and that's what's on the ballot in June.
Seth, this originally was approved with something like 60% of the vote. Where were these voices before? Were they saying the same things and predicting this outcome, and voters just did not, you know, pick up on that? What do you think happened?
Well, what happened was there wasn't really a campaign on this. There was one guy in California who's a billionaire who gave every cent of every dollar to gather up the signatures to put this on the ballot and to campaign for its approval. And there really wasn't any organized opposition to speak of. And that's a symbol of our process today. You know, one guy with a lot of money who wants to get a law passed can just kind of pay to get it passed in a place like South Dakota. And, you know, that's essentially what happened. And then we were stuck dealing as a state with some of the problems that we encountered with the law after it was passed on the strength of all that money and advertising that Henry Nicholas, the billionaire who supported the law, was able to do. And so, you know, it is, for those of us in the media, have been affected by it a little bit in not being able to get information about, traffic accident victims and other information from the court system that we're accustomed to getting. So it's nice to see some changes coming to it, but I just think it's, we've spent 2 years of time on this issue that nobody in South Dakota proposed. Somebody in California thought we should have this law, so now we have it, and now we're trying to deal with it.
John, you know, when we compare this, it was on the same ballot as initiated Measure 22, which ran into trouble in the state legislature. Will voters see those two as connected, or do they make the distinction, you think, of, you know, something different happened with IM-22 than what happened with Marcy's Law, constitutional amendment?
My instinct says that people will be able to differentiate between the two. Part of the repeal of IM-22 was, passed, it had some controversy, and in its repeal, it was couched in controversy, and it still remains that today. Marcy's Law wasn't particularly controversial, as Seth was saying, when it was passed, and now you've got both sides agreeing on modifications. I don't think that people will perceive that as something that, the people couldn't defeat it in the first place. With IM-22, I think some people believe that. you know, couldn't get defeated in the first place. Here's an end around that they got it defeated anyway. So I think there's much more acrimony with that than there is the Marcy's, which I think will pass.
John, do you think people will consider those ballot measures differently? Will they be more cautious, more, apt to think about did we learn anything from it? Or is it just going to happen again, is what I really want to know.
I think so. And, you know, you and I talked about this in December about the number of ballot issues that we face and so forth. And I give a lot of credit to South Dakota voters because I think they studied these things. And anytime you go to the ballot box, it's not going to be a perfect, people are going to be influenced by a lot of different sources. But by and large, I think people took them seriously and said, you know, thought about them and did what they thought was right. So I have some confidence in South Dakota voters if they can get the information. And when you do have one-sided campaigns, it's harder to get good information, right, if you have only one sponsor of those. But as long as we don't get up to, 15, 20, a million different ballot initiatives, I think people will take them seriously and it'll be an effective process.
Seth, I know we want to move on from this, but one more question about this, and that's, when you look back at, I'm thinking about our coverage of Marcy's Law before the election and who we brought on and what they said, and I remember some features from Victoria Wicks. When you look back at your coverage, do you think, or statewide coverage with other organizations, did we as journalists do enough to find out the real story behind that in a one-sided campaign? Because it's part of our responsibility to let voters know what exactly is on that ballot. Yes?
Well, I think we did a good job in laying out who is behind the law. There was a lot of reporting
right,
on that,
yeah.
And I did some of that on who is behind it, who is paying for it. But I don't think we did a good enough job examining the ballot measure itself and what exactly it would do. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, we didn't know what it would exactly, what impact it would have until it's put in place and interpreted by the various state's attorneys around the state and by the attorney general. So, there could have been more coverage, but part of that is a function of, I don't remember it, but we had 8 or 10 or 12 ballot issues or something in that election year, plus other, races to cover. And at a certain point, a few things get lost in the shuffle as people prioritize. And frankly, I would imagine a lot of people look at this as, as I've said, something that a guy from California, a California billionaire, puts on the ballot. Interest maybe wasn't as high in that among journalists as it was in other things that originated from inside the state.
Sure.
Well, maybe, Lori, you could be a South Dakota billionaire and get some things affected.
I'm so on my way already, John. I mean, my savings account is growing month by month. It's only a matter of time.
Okay. We'll
I'll use my influence wisely when that time comes. Let's talk about school funding. What's ahead for that? Because the gubernatorial candidates, South Dakota Attorney General Marty Jackley, Congresswoman Kristi Noem, are both talking about whether or not we need some adjustments and some tweaks to the results and the implementation of the findings of the Blue Ribbon Task Force. Where do you want to begin with that, Seth?
Well, I think if they're talking about tweaks, they'll find a receptive audience to that. I mean, anytime you overhaul the funding formula for K-12 education, as the legislators did in recent years, in the following years, there's going to be things you're going to find that were unintended consequences and little tweaks that need to be made. If they want to, do another overhaul, I think they're going to have problems because I think people remember the Blue Ribbon Task Force that ended up proposing the increase in the sales tax that was passed to raise teacher salaries. That was a bruising battle, and quite a few legislators were voted out of office in the Black Hills for supporting that effort. And so if you're going to talk about doing another overhaul of education funding, I'm not sure legislators will be ready or willing to take on that battle, but certainly, a few tweaks here and there, I think probably would find success.
John, the real challenge is those smaller schools, as I understand that.
Right, and it will continue. I mean, the demographics of our school systems change all the time, and by and large, small school districts are getting smaller and large districts are getting larger. Mm. So, but if you get two candidates, remember, neither of them is running as an incumbent, and you get two essentially challengers, and they say, so each idea that they discuss are typically going to be change, right? I mean, so no one's going to say, look, let's keep everything the way it was. I'll just mail it in. So they're proposing changes, but again, the tweak, as Seth was describing, is probably better. It hasn't been very long since we had this overhaul, and the uncertainty of constant changes in the formula by the legislature is unsettling to schools, and probably the reason we have, at times, school districts are holding extra money in reserve, because they just, you know, if every January their funding is somehow going to be changed or at risk, they prepare for that at the school board level. So there's certainly an argument for saying, let this formula run for a little bit and get used to that. And if you want to make tweaks, I understand. But I think there would be no audience for a major overhaul.
Right. Primary is we're sort of heading toward there kind of quickly, and Seth, maybe we aren't fully prepared to talk about the funding, but we kind of see a pretty tight race between Nome and Jack Lee, don't we, from a financial standpoint, and just sort of what the candidates are saying. There's some real distinctions, but some real similarities. What are your thoughts about where we're at with that governor's race right now?
Well, as maybe some of your listeners have read a column by Bob Mercer, a Capital correspondent that we subscribe to, there isn't really any great independent polling out there, so
right.
I don't know where we're at in that race. Only thing we have to go on is, anecdotal observations and the money race, which the money race would seem to reflect what I think a lot of people just have assumed all along, that Kristi Noem probably began with a lead, and this was sort of her race to lose, but that it would be very competitive. I wish we had polling to show whether that's correct or not, but the only polling we have is all kind of suspicious, because it came from or was promoted by one campaign or the other, so it's really difficult to tell where we're at. But certainly the money race would indicate perhaps Noem has a lead, as maybe some would have suspected all along, but both of them have been running very hard, and I wouldn't make any predictions about who's going to win, because I think it'd be very competitive.
Right. John Hunter, how do candidates finish strong in these final 2 weeks? We reached out to talk to Congresswoman Noem about a topic, and, they said, yes, we're willing to come on, but their window was really small because of everything they're trying to get done in these final weeks, their window of availability. What do they need to do to finish strong at this point?
In my opinion, get that message directly to voters. They do rely on a lot of different types of media, from television to newspapers to electronic digital media and so on. But I think, I tend not to put as much stock either in polling or in the money race fundraising for either of those, because I think it takes the discussion away from the actual issues. So I think we have two conservative candidates in this thing, Republicans, similar in a lot of ways, both capable. And so I think really they, whatever differences they have, I think if they can get that directly to voters, not necessarily the general public, but those who vote, and make those distinctions, I think that's how you finish strong.
Yeah, I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about a series that Seth Tupper has in the Rapid City Journal. You can find it online on their website, rapidcityjournal.com. And this is all about the Legion Lake fire. So, first of all, some really excellent reporting here, Seth, because it sounds like some of those answers about what happened to cause the fire, could it have been prevented, what should be done next, are not necessarily easy answers to find. Give me an idea of how long you've been working on this piece. These pieces.
Well, it was I don't know, several weeks at least, but I got encouragement from a source who said, you guys really haven't looked hard enough at the causes of this fire, and it got strong encouragement from a source. So I said, okay, I'll take a look at it. And I think all along we had all looked at the fires. There had been a week-long period of very, very strong winds in the Black Hills, and it was dry, and there was no snow on the ground in December when this fire happened, and just kind of looked at it as an act of God, and or so to speak. And
right.
Certainly it was, but when you take a closer look at the investigation report on the fire, the thing that I really keyed in on was the fact that this was a 70-foot tall, apparently seemingly healthy ponderosa pine tree. It was not infested with mountain pine beetles, that blew over onto a power line that was probably about 20 feet off the ground and caused this fire. And I thought, that's really fascinating, because I think there's probably an assumption out there that this was a mountain pine beetle infested tree or whatever, but It was a perfectly, seemingly healthy tree, 70 foot tall, outside of the power line right of way, that nonetheless blew over in a 50 mile per hour wind and caused this huge fire. Yeah. And of course, if you look across the Black Hills, there are millions upon millions of trees that are tall enough and seemingly healthy and outside of the right of way, but still close enough to fall on a power line. So that's a really tricky problem, I guess, that utilities and land managers have to look at and be aware of, and realize that we're always at risk of another Legion Lake fire from a tree that we have no idea when and where it could fall on a power line.
Right, and there are open questions, like why there could be reasons why that tree fell that could have been prevented. It couldn't, because it's unlikely that it would have fallen. So what are the other open questions that we still sort of don't know, either because we just don't know or because people aren't talking?
Well, nobody wants to talk because there's rumors of litigation. I don't know of any filed yet, but there's been rumors of possible litigation from people whose private property was burned, you know, by the fire. So nobody really wants to talk, but I did learn in the reporting that the state did have a tree expert at South Dakota State University examine this tree. And, you know, I think that person knows, you know, I had a short conversation with that expert, tree expert, by phone, and I said, you know, why did the tree fall over? And he said, well, that's the interesting question. And then he stopped short and said he needed to talk to a lawyer for the state before he could talk to me anymore.
Right.
So they didn't give him permission to talk. So yeah, there could have been problems with the roots or whatever. We just don't know. And we don't know if that's anything that would have been detectable, you know, to a company that came along to trim the right-of-way or anything like that.
Yeah.
And again, that's what's kind of scary about it.
Let's pause for a second and bring John Hunter back in here, because how often does that happen to you in your career, or journalists that you know, when you're asking a question, they say, oh, that's a good question, and then, yeah, we can't talk about it anymore because lawyers have gotten involved, and the public really doesn't get the information they need then, right?
Yeah, Laurie, it happens a lot, and I understand those kind of circumstances, but for the Legion Lake fire in particular, this is clearly a public issue. And yes, I understand there are private issues to that, but this is not a dispute between two neighbors or dispute among a business here and a business in another town. This is a public issue, and so those are the things that the public deserves to know. And and I think there's a legitimate fear in our litigious society where people say, if I say one wrong word, there's going to be someone who sues me over it and that sort of thing. So it's a fear that some people have. Unfortunately, I think with some public officials, that, you know, they are fear of that also, and that's part of the reason we have challenges with closed meetings for local governments, is because they said, gee, I don't want to say something wrong and then get sued for it. So. And then the public suffers because they don't get to know as much about their local governments. Yeah. So it does happen often, and I wish it wouldn't, but we'll keep trying.
Seth, one of the things that struck me as I read through all this work that you did, such fine investigations, was that, you know, there were ranchers and landowners who were upset, and then, you know, looking into everything from the slash piles in the Black Hills to, you know, the power company's role, what needs to happen next, and it seemed like there are a whole lot of people who need to work together to, you know, deal with issues like this in the future, and some of what's happening now might, you know, cause some friction in how people are working together and how that communication works. Did you get the same sense?
Yeah, and that's something that I've always wanted to explore more in my reporting, is I think, you know, lay people who aren't land managers or firefighters or whatever, we tend to look at the Black Hills as one big, you know, cohesive thing. And really, the Black Hills is split up into all kinds of different federal and state agencies. You know, Custer State Park is Game Fish and Parks. The Black Hills National Forest is the U.S. Department of Agriculture. You got national parks, you know, you got national monuments, you got the Bureau of Land Management, all these different agencies involved, and they all kind of operate in their own silos. And if you have concerns that go across the entire Black Hills area, like wildfires, it really does point to a need for maybe a little more interagency communication and cooperation on things like, you know, where are all the slash piles from lumber, from logging operations in the forest? And does somebody know that for the entire forest, or do all the individual agencies just know that for their own agency, and right, et cetera? So, if anything comes out of it, I think hopefully that's it, that more communication, more coordination, more work across agency lines, so to speak.
Yeah, you can find that work at rapidcityjournal.com, and it's a good example of why we need newspapers. Seth Tupper, thank you so much for being here today. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Don Hunter, thanks for being here as well. Always a pleasure.
It is, Lori. Thank you.